Chapter 18. East London. Finding Peter Jordan would not be a problem. Finding him the right way would. Fogel's information was good. Berlin knew Jordan worked at Grosvenor Square at the Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force, better known as SHAFE. The square was heavily patrolled by military policemen, impenetrable to an outsider. Berlin had the address of Jordan's house in Kensington and had put together an extraordinary amount of information on Jordan's background. What was missing was a minute-by-minute account of his daily routine in London. Without it, Catherine could only guess at how best to make her approach. Following Jordan herself was out of the question for a number of reasons. The first dealt with her personal security. It would be very dangerous for her to trail an American officer through the West End of London. She could be spotted by military policemen or by Jordan himself. If the officers were feeling especially diligent, they could bring her in for questioning. A little checking might reveal that the real Catherine Blake died 30 years ago at the age of 8 months, and that she was a German agent. The second reason for not following Peter Jordan herself was purely practical. It was virtually impossible for her to do the job correctly alone. Even if Neumann helped, it would be difficult. The first time Jordan stepped into a military staff car, she would be completely helpless. She couldn't walk up to a taxi and say, "Follow that American staff car." Cabbies were aware of the threat posed to Allied officers by spies. She might be driven straight to the nearest police station instead. She needed nondescript vehicles to tail him, nondescript men to walk with him, nondescript men to maintain a static post outside his home. She needed help. She needed Vernon Pope. Vernon Pope was one of London's biggest and most successful underworld figures. Pope, along with his brother Robert, ran protection rackets, illegal gambling parlors, prostitution rings, and a thriving black market operation. Early in the war, Vernon Pope had brought Robert to the emergency room at St. Thomas Hospital with a serious head wound suffered in the Blitz. Catherine examined him quickly, saw that he was concussed, and suspected his skull might have been fractured. She made certain Robert was seen by a doctor straight away. A grateful Vernon Pope had left a note for her. It said, "If there's ever anything I can do to repay you, please don't hesitate to ask." Catherine kept the note. It was in her handbag. Somehow, Vernon Pope's warehouse had survived the bombing. It stood intact, an arrogant island surrounded by seas of destruction. Catherine had not ventured to the East End in nearly 4 years. The devastation was shocking. It was difficult to make certain she was not being followed. There were few doorways left for shelter, no boxes for false telephone calls, no shops for a small purchase, just endless mountains of debris. She watched the warehouse from across the street, a light cold rain falling. She wore trousers, sweater, and a leather coat. The doors of the warehouse were pulled back, and 3 heavy lorries rumbled out into the street. A pair of well-dressed men pulled them shut quickly, but not before Catherine caught a glimpse inside. It was a beehive of activity. A knot of dock workers walked past her, coming off the day shift. She dropped in a few paces behind them and walked toward the Pope warehouse. There was a small gate with an electric buzzer for deliveries. She pressed it, received no answer, and pressed it again. Catherine felt she was being watched. Finally, the gate drew back. "What can we do for you, love?" The pleasant Cockney voice did not match the figure before her. He stood well over 6 feet tall, with black hair cropped close to his skull and small spectacles. He wore an expensive grey suit with a white shirt and silver tie. The muscles of his upper arms filled out the sleeves of the jacket. "I'd like to speak to Mr. Pope, please." Catherine handed the hulk the note. He read quickly, as though he had seen many of them before. "I'll ask the boss if he has a minute to see you. Come inside." Catherine stepped through the gate, and he closed it behind her. "Hands above your head, darling. That's a good girl. Nothing personal. Mr. Pope requires it of everyone." Pope's man patted her down. It was brisk and not very professional. She cringed as he ran his hands over her breasts. She resisted an impulse to crush his nose with her elbow. He opened her handbag, glanced inside, and handed it back. She had expected this, so she had come unarmed. She felt naked without a weapon, vulnerable. Next time she would bring a stiletto. He led her through the warehouse. Men dressed in overalls were loading crates of goods into half a dozen vans. At the far end of the warehouse, boxes stood floor to ceiling on wooden pallets. Coffee, cigarettes, sugar, as well as barrels of petrol. There was a fleet of shining motorbikes parked in a neat row. Vernon Pope was obviously doing a brisk business. "This way, love," he said. "Name's Dicky, by the way." He led her into a freight lift, pulled shut the doors, and pressed the button. Catherine reached into her purse for a cigarette and stuck it between her lips. "Sorry, darling," said Dicky, waving a finger in disapproval. "The boss hates fags. Says one day we're going to find out they're killing us. Besides, there's enough petrol and ammunition in this place to blow us clear to Glasgow."
"That's some favour," Vernon Pope said.
He rose from his comfortable leather sofa and roamed his office. It was not just an office, but more like a small flat, with a seating area and a kitchen filled with modern appliances. There was a bedroom behind a pair of black teak doors. They parted briefly, and Catherine spotted a drowsy blonde waiting impatiently for the meeting to conclude. Pope poured himself another whiskey. He was tall and handsome, with pale skin, fair brilliantined hair, wintry grey eyes. His suit was carefully tailored and circumspect. It might have been worn by a successful executive or someone born to wealth.
"Can you imagine that, Robert? Catherine here actually wants us to spend 3 days chasing an American naval officer around the West End."
Robert Pope remained at the fringes, pacing like a skittish grey wolf.
"That's not really our line of work, Catherine, darling," Vernon Pope said. "Besides, what if the Yank or British security boys catch on to our little game? The London police I deal with, MI5, is another story."
Catherine withdrew a cigarette. "Do you mind?"
"If you must. Dickie, give her an ashtray."
Catherine lit the cigarette and smoked quietly for a moment.
"I've seen the equipment you have downstairs in your warehouse. You could easily mount the kind of surveillance operation I'm talking about."
"And why in the world would a volunteer nurse from St. Thomas Hospital want to mount a surveillance operation on an Allied officer, Robert, I ask you?"
Robert Pope knew he was not expected to provide an answer. Vernon Pope moved to the window, drink cupped in his hand. The blackout curtains were raised, giving him a view of the boats working up and down the river.
"Look at what the Germans have done to this place," he said finally. "Used to be the centre of the world, the biggest port on the face of the earth. And now look at it, a bloody wasteland. Things will never be the same around here. You're not working for the Germans, are you, Catherine?"
"Of course not," she said calmly. "My reasons for following him are strictly personal."
"Good. I'm a thief, but I'm still a patriot."
He paused, then asked,
"So why do you want him followed?"
"I'm offering you a job, Mr. Pope. Frankly, the reasons why are none of your business."
Pope turned around and faced her.
"Very good, Catherine. You've got guts. I like that. Besides, you'd be a fool to tell me."
The bedroom doors parted and the blonde emerged, wearing a man's paisley silk robe. It was tied loosely at the waist, revealing a good pair of legs and small, upturned breasts.
"Vivi, we're not finished yet," Pope said.
"I was thirsty."
She glanced at Catherine while pouring herself a gin and tonic.
"How much longer are you going to be, Vernon?"
"Not long. Business, darling. Back in the bedroom."
Vivi moved back to the bedroom, hips flowing beneath the gown. She threw another glance at Catherine over her shoulder before softly closing the door.
"Pretty girl," Catherine said. "You're a lucky man."
Vernon Pope laughed quietly and shook his head.
"Sometimes I wish I could bestow some of my luck on another man."
There was a long silence while Pope paced the room.
"I'm into a lot of shady things, Catherine, but I don't like this. I don't like it one little bit."
Catherine lit another cigarette. Maybe she had made a mistake by approaching Vernon Pope with the offer.
"But I'm going to do it. You helped my brother, and I made you a promise. I'm a man of my word."
He paused, looking her up and down.
"Besides, There's something about you I like, very much.
I'm glad we can do business together, Mr. Pope.
It's going to cost you, love. I've got a lot of overhead. I've got wages to pay. This kind of thing is going to take a good deal of my resources.
That's why I came to you.
Catherine reached inside her purse and withdrew an envelope. How does £200 sound?
100 now, 100 on delivery of the information.
I want Commander Jordan followed for 72 hours, 24 hours a day. I want a minute-by-minute accounting of his movements. I want to know where he eats, who he meets with, and what they talk about. I want to know if he's seeing any women. Can you manage that, Mr. Pope?
Of course.
Good. Then I'll contact you on Saturday.
How can I reach you?
Actually, you can't.
Catherine laid the envelope on the table and got to her feet. Vernon Pope smiled pleasantly.
I thought you would say that. Dickie, show Catherine the way out. Put together a bag of groceries for her. Some coffee, some sugar, maybe a little tinned beef if that shipment came in. Something nice, Dickie.
I have a bad feeling about this one, Vernon, Robert Pope said. Maybe we should drop the whole thing.
Vernon Pope hated to be questioned by his younger brother. As far as Vernon was concerned, he made the business decisions and Robert handled the muscle.
It's nothing we can't handle. Did you have her followed?
Dickie and the boys picked her up as she left the warehouse.
Good. I want to know who that woman is and what she's playing at.
Maybe we could turn this to our advantage. We could buy ourselves some goodwill with the police if we quietly tell them what she's up to.
We'll do nothing of the kind. Is that clear?
Maybe you should think a little more about business and a little less about getting it wet.
Vernon turned on him and grabbed him by the throat.
What I do is none of your goddamn business. Besides, it's a hell of a lot better than what you and Dickie do.
Robert visibly reddened.
Why are you looking at me like that, Robert? You think I don't know what goes on?
Vernon released his grip.
Now get out on the street where you belong and make sure Dickie doesn't lose her.
Catherine spotted the tale 2 minutes after leaving the warehouse. She had expected it. Men like Vernon Pope don't stay in business long unless they are cautious and suspicious. But the tale was clumsy and amateurish. After all, Dickie had been the one who had greeted her, searched her, and taken her inside. She knew his face. Stupid of them to put him on the street to follow her. Losing him would be easy. She ducked into an underground station, melting into the evening crowds. She crossed through the tunnel and emerged on the other side of the street. A bus was waiting. She boarded it and found a seat next to an elderly woman. Through the fogged window she watched Dickie charge up the stairs into the street, panic on his face. She felt a little sorry for him. Poor Dickie was no match for a professional, and Vernon Pope would be furious. She would take no chances. A taxi ride, 2 or 3 more buses, a stroll through the West End before returning to her flat. For now, she settled into her seat and enjoyed the ride. The bedroom was dark when Vernon Pope entered and quietly closed the doors. Vivi rose to her knees at the end of the bed. Vernon kissed her deeply. He was being rougher than usual. Vivi thought she knew why. She slid her hand down the front of his trousers.
"Oh my God, Vernon, is this for me or that bitch?"
Vernon parted the silk robe and pushed it down over her shoulders.
"A little of both, I'm afraid," he said, kissing her again.
"You wanted her right there in the office. I could see it on your face."
"You always were a perceptive little girl."
She kissed him again.
"When is she coming back?"
"End of the week."
"What's her name?"
"Calls herself Catherine."
"Catherine," Vivi said. "What a lovely name. She's beautiful."
"Yes,"
Pope said distantly.
"What kind of business is she into?"
Pope told her about the meeting. There were no secrets between them.
"Sounds a bit touchy. I think we could bring a good bit of leverage to bear on her."
"You're a very smart girl."
"No, just a very nasty girl."
"Vivi, I can tell when your mind is working in evil ways."
She laughed wickedly. I have 3 days to dream up all the wonderful things we can do to that woman when she comes back. Now, take off your pants so I can help ease your pain.
Vernon Pope did as he was told. A moment later, there was a soft knock at the door. Robert Pope stepped inside without waiting for an answer. A shaft of light partially illuminated the scene. Vivi looked up, unashamed, and smiled. Vernon exploded in anger.
How many times have I told you not to come in here when the door is closed?
It's important. She got away from us.
How in the hell did that happen?
Dickie swears she was there 1 minute and gone the next. She just vanished.
For Christ's sake!
No one gets away from Dickie. She's obviously a professional. We ought to stay as far away from her as possible.
Vivi felt a stab of panic.
Get out of here and close the door, Robert.
When Robert was gone, Vivi licked Vernon playfully.
You're not going to take that little queer's advice, are you, Vernon?
Of course not.
Good, she said. Now, where were we?
Oh, my God.
Vernon groaned. Chapter 19. London. Early the following morning, Robert Pope and Richard Dickie Dobbs made their unwitting debut in the world of wartime espionage with a hastily improvised surveillance of Commander Peter Jordan that would have made the watchers of MI5 a touch green with envy. It began before the damp, freezing dawn, when the pair arrived outside Jordan's Edwardian house in Kensington in a black panelled van, complete with boxes of tinned food in the back and the name of a West End grocer on the side. They waited there until shortly before 8 o'clock, Pope dozing, Dickie nervously munching a soggy bun and drinking coffee from a paper cup. Vernon Pope had threatened him with grievous bodily harm over last night's foul-up with the woman. He was damned if he was going to lose Peter Jordan. Dickie, considered the finest wheelman in London's criminal underground, had secretly vowed to pursue Jordan across the lawns of Green Park if need be. Such motoring heroics would not be necessary, for at 7:55 an American military staff car drew up outside Jordan's house and blew its horn. The door of the house opened, and a man of medium height and build emerged. He wore a U.S. Navy uniform, a white cap, and a dark overcoat. A thin leather briefcase hung at the end of his arm. He vanished into the back of the car and closed the door. Dickie had been concentrating on Jordan so intently he forgot to start the engine. When he tried to do so, it coughed once and died. He cursed it, threatened it, and cajoled it before trying again. This time the van roared into life, and their silent watch on Peter Jordan was underway. Grosvenor Square would present them with their first challenge. It was crowded with taxis, staff cars, and allied officers rushing in every direction. Jordan's car passed through the square, entered an adjacent side street, and stopped outside a small, unmarked building. Remaining on the street was impossible. Vehicles were parked on both sides with only one lane for traffic, and a white-helmeted MP was pacing up and down, lazily swinging his baton. Pope hopped out and walked back and forth along the street while Dickie circled. 10 minutes later, Jordan emerged from the building, a heavy briefcase chained to his wrist. Dickie collected Pope and headed back to Grosvenor Square, arriving in time to spot Jordan walking through the front entrance of Schaeff headquarters. He found a parking space in Grosvenor Street with a clear view and turned off the engine. A few minutes later, they caught a glimpse of General Eisenhower flashing one of his famous smiles before disappearing through the entrance. Pope, even if he'd been trained by MI5 itself, could not have discharged his next moves any better. He determined that they could not cover the building with a static post alone. It was a huge complex, with many ways in and out. Using a public phone, he telephoned Vernon at the warehouse and demanded 3 men. When they arrived, he posted one behind the building in Blackburn Street, another in Upper Brook Street, and the third in Upper Grosvenor Street. 2 hours later, Pope called the warehouse again and demanded 3 fresh faces. It wasn't safe for civilians to loiter around American installations. Vickery and Boothby, had they been able to hear the conversation, might have laughed at the irony, for like any good desk man and field agent, Vernon and Robert quarrelled bitterly over resources. The stakes were different, though.
Vernon needed a couple of good men to pick up a shipment of stolen coffee and to rough up a shopkeeper who had fallen behind with his protection payments. They changed vehicles at midday. The grocer's van was replaced by an identical van with the name of a fictitious laundry service stenciled on the side. It was so quickly prepared that the word laundry was spelled laundry, and the white clothes bags piled in the back were stuffed with crumpled old newspapers. At 2 o'clock, they were brought a thermos flask of tea and a bag of sandwiches. An hour later, having finished eating and smoking a pair of cigarettes, Pope was growing nervous. Jordan had been inside nearly 7 hours. It was getting late. Every side of the building was covered. But if Jordan left in the gloom of the blackout, it would be nearly impossible to spot him. But at 4 o'clock, the light almost gone, Jordan left the building by the main door on Grosvenor Square. He repeated the same circuit as the morning, only in reverse. He walked across the square to the smaller building, the same heavy briefcase chained to his wrist, and went inside. He emerged a few moments later carrying the smaller briefcase he had had earlier that morning. The rain had stopped, and Jordan apparently decided a walk would do him good. He headed west, then turned south in Park Lane. Following him in the van would be impossible. Pope hopped out and shadowed Jordan along the pavement, staying several yards behind him. It was more difficult than Pope imagined. The large Grosvenor House Hotel in Park Lane had been taken over by the Americans as a billet for officers. Dozens of people jammed the pavement outside. Pope moved closer to Jordan to make certain he didn't mistake him for one of the other men. A military policeman glanced at Pope as he sliced through the crowd after Jordan. On some streets in the West End, Englishmen stuck out the same way they would in Topeka, Kansas. Pope tensed. Then he realized he wasn't doing anything wrong. He was simply walking down the street in his own country. He relaxed and the MP looked away. Jordan walked past Grosvenor House. Pope moved carefully behind him. Pope lost him at Hyde Park Corner. Jordan had vanished into a crowd of soldiers and British civilians waiting to cross the street. When the light changed, Pope followed an American naval officer roughly Jordan's height along Grosvenor Place. Then he looked down and realized the officer wasn't carrying a briefcase. He stopped and looked behind him, hoping Jordan would be there. He was gone. Pope heard a horn blast in the street and looked up. It was Dickie. "He's in Knightsbridge," Dickie said. "Get in!" Dickie executed a perfect U-turn through the buzzing evening traffic. Pope spotted Jordan a moment later and breathed a sigh of relief. Dickie pulled over and Pope jumped out. Determined not to lose his man again, Pope closed to within a few feet of him. The Van Dyke Club was a club for American officers in Kensington, off-limits to British civilians. Jordan went inside. Pope walked a few feet past the doorway, then doubled back. Dickie had pulled to the curb across the street. Pope, winded and chilled, climbed inside and closed the door. He lit a cigarette and finished the dregs of tea in the thermos. Then he said, "Next time Commander Jordan decides to walk halfway across London, you get out and walk with him, Dickie." Jordan came out 45 minutes later. Pope thought, please God, not another forced march. Jordan stepped to the curb and flagged down a taxi. Dickie dropped the van into gear and eased carefully out into the traffic. Following the taxi was easier. It headed east, past Trafalgar Square and into the Strand. Then, after travelling a short distance, it turned right. Pope said, "Now this is more like it." They watched as Jordan paid off his taxi and stepped inside the Savoy Hotel. The vast majority of British civilians survived the war on subsistence levels of food, a few ounces of meat and cheese each week, a few ounces of milk, one egg if they were lucky, delicacies like tinned peaches and tomatoes once in a great while. No one was starving, but few people put on weight. But there was another London. The London of fine restaurants and lavish hotels, which secured a steady supply of meat, fish, vegetables, wine, and coffee on the black market, then charged their customers exorbitant prices for the privilege of dining there. The Savoy Hotel was one of those establishments. The doorman wore a green greatcoat, trimmed in silver, and a stovepipe hat. Pope brushed past him and went inside. He crossed the lobby and entered the salon. There were rich businessmen, reclining in the comfortable easy chairs, beautiful women in fashionable wartime evening clothes, dozens of American and British officers in uniform, Tweedy landed gentry up from the country for a few days in the city. Pope, following Jordan through the crowd, had a mixed reaction to the opulent scene. The West End rich were living the high life, while the underprivileged East Enders were hungry and suffering the most from the Blitz. But then, he and his brother had made a fortune in the black market. He dismissed the disparity as an unfortunate consequence of war. Pope followed Jordan into the grill bar. Jordan stood alone among the throng, trying vainly to get the bartender's attention to order a drink. Pope stood a few feet from him. He caught the bartender's eye and ordered a whiskey. When he turned around, Jordan had been joined by a tall American naval officer with a red face and a good-natured smile. Pope took a step closer, so he could hear their conversation. The tall man said,
"Hitler should come here and try to get a drink on a Friday night. I'm sure he'd have second thoughts about wanting to invade this country."
"You want to try our luck at Grosvenor House?" Jordan asked.
"Willow Run? Are you out of your mind? The French chef quit the other day. They ordered him to make the meals out of sea rations, and he refused."
"Sounds like the last sane man in London."
"I'll say.
What do you have to do to get a drink around this place?"
"This usually works. 2 martinis, for Christ's sake!"
The bartender looked up, grinned, and reached for a bottle of Beefeaters. "Hello, Mr. Ramsay."
"Hello, William."
Pope made a mental note. Jordan's friend was named Ramsay. "Well done, Shepherd." Pope thought, "Shepherd Ramsay.
It helps to be a foot taller than anyone else."
"Did you make a reservation? There's no way we're going to get in the grill tonight without one."
"Of course I did, old sport. Where the hell have you been, anyway? I tried calling you last week. Let the telephone at your house ring off the hook. No answer. Rang your office as well. They said you couldn't come to the phone. Rang back the next day. Same story. What the hell were you doing that you couldn't come to the phone for 2 days?
"None of your business."
"Ah, still working on that project of yours, are you?"
"Drop it, Shepherd, or I'll knock you on your ass right here in this bar."
"In your dreams, old sport. Besides, if you make a scene in here, where the hell will we do our drinking? No decent establishment would have your kind."
"Good point."
"So when are you going to tell me what you've been working on?"
"When the war is over."
"That important, huh?"
"Yeah."
"Well, at least one of us is doing something important."
Shepherd Ramsay downed his drink.
"William, 2 more, please."
"Are we going to get drunk before dinner tonight?"
"I just want you to loosen up, that's all."
"This is about as loose as I get. What are you up to, Shepherd?" I know that tone of voice.
"Nothing, Peter. Jesus, take it easy."
"Tell me, you know how I hate surprises."
"I've invited a couple of people to join us tonight."
"People?"
"Girls, actually. In fact, they've just arrived."
Pope followed Jordan's gaze toward the front of the bar. There were 2 women, both young, both very attractive. The women spotted Shepherd Ramsay and Jordan and joined them at the bar.
"Peter, this is Barbara, but most people call her Baby."
"That's understandable. Pleasure to meet you, Barbara." Barbara looked at Shepherd.
"God, you were right. He's a doll."
She spoke with a working-class London accent.
"Are we eating in the grill?"
"Yes. In fact, our table should be ready."
The maitre d'hôtel showed them to their table. There was no way Pope could listen to their conversation from the bar. He needed to be seated at the next table. Gazing through the entrance of the dining room, Pope could see the table beside them was empty but had a small reserved sign on it. No problem, he thought. He quickly crossed the bar and went out into the street. Dicky was waiting in the front of the van. Pope waved for him to come inside. Dicky climbed out and crossed the street.
"What is it, Robert?"
"We're having dinner. I need you to make the reservation."
Pope sent Dicky to speak to the maitre d'hotel. The first time Dicky asked for the table, the man shook his head, frowned, and waved his hands to show there were no tables to be had. Then Dicky leaned down and whispered something into his ear that made him turn white and start to tremble. A moment later, they were being seated at the table next to Peter Jordan and Shepherd Ramsay.
"What did you say to him, Dicky?"
"I told him if he didn't give us this table, I'd rip out his Adam's apple and drop it into that flaming pan over there."
"Well, the customer is always right. That's what I say."
They opened their menus. Pope said,
"Are you going to start with the smoked salmon or the pâté de foie gras?"
"Both, I think. I'm starving. You don't suppose they serve bangers and mash here, do you, Robert?"
"Not bloody likely. Try the coq au vin. Now keep quiet so I can hear what these Yanks are saying."
It was Dicky who followed them outside after dinner. He watched as they placed the two women into a taxi and set out along the Strand.
"You might at least have been civil."
"I'm sorry, Shepherd. We didn't have much to talk about."
"What's there to talk about? You have a few drinks, a few laughs, you take her home and have a wonderful evening in bed. No questions asked."
"I had trouble getting past the fact that she kept using her knife to check her lipstick."
"Do you know what she could have done to you with those lips? And did you get a look at what she had beneath that dress? My God, Peter, that girl has one of the worst reputations in London."
"I'm sorry to disappoint you, Shepherd. I just wasn't interested."
"Well, when are you going to get interested?"
"What are you talking about?"
6 months ago, you promised me you were going to start dating."
Jordan lit a cigarette and angrily waved out the match. "I would like to meet an intelligent, interesting grown-up. I don't need you to go out and find me a girl." "Listen, Shep, I'm sorry."
"No, you're right. It's none of my business. It's just that my mother died when my father was 40. He never remarried. As a result, he died a lonely, bitter old man. I don't want the same thing to happen to you."
"Thanks, Shepherd. It won't."
"You'll never find another woman like Margaret."
"Tell me something I don't know." Jordan flagged down a taxi and climbed in. "Can I give you a lift?"
"Actually, I have a previous engagement."
"Shepherd."
"She's meeting me back in my room in half an hour." "I couldn't resist. Forgive me, but the flesh is weak."
"More than the flesh. Have a good time, Shep." The taxi drove off. Dicky peeled away and looked for the van. Pope pulled over to the curb a few seconds later and Dicky climbed inside. They followed the taxi back into Kensington, saw Peter Jordan to his door, and stayed there a half hour, waiting for the night shift to arrive. Chapter 20. London. It had been Alfred Vickery's inability to repair a motorbike that led to his shattered knee. It happened on a glorious autumn day in the north of France, and without a doubt it was the worst day of his life. Vickery had just finished a meeting with a spy who had gone behind enemy lines in a sector where the British planned to attack at dawn the next morning. The spy had discovered a large bivouac of German soldiers. The attack, if it went forward as planned, would be met with heavy resistance. The spy gave Vickery a handwritten note on the strength of the German troops and the number of artillery pieces he had spotted. He also gave Vickery a map showing exactly where they were camped. Vickery placed them in his leather saddlebag and set out back to headquarters. Vickery knew he was carrying intelligence of vital importance. Lives were at stake. He opened the throttle full and drove perilously fast along the narrow track. Large trees lined both sides of the path, a canopy of limbs overhead, the sunlight on the autumn leaves creating a flickering tunnel of fire. The path rose and fell rhythmically beneath him. Several times he felt the exhilarating thrill of his Rudge motorbike soaring airborne for a second or two. The engine rattle began 10 miles from headquarters. Vickery eased off the throttle. Over the next mile the rattle progressed to a loud clatter. A mile later he heard the sound of snapping metal, followed by a loud bang. The engine suddenly lost power and died. With the roar of the bike gone, the silence was oppressive. He bent down and looked at the motor. The hot, greasy metal and twisting cables meant nothing to him. He remembered actually kicking the thing and debating whether he should leave it by the roadside or drag it back to headquarters. He took hold of it by the handlebars and began pushing at a brisk pace. The afternoon light diminished to a frail pink dusk. He was still miles from headquarters. If he were lucky, Vickery might run into someone from his own side who could give him a lift. If he were unlucky, he might find himself face to face with a patrol of German scouts. When the last of the twilight had died away, the shelling began. The first shells fell short, landing harmlessly in a field. The next shells soared overhead and thudded against a hillside. The third volley landed on the track directly in front of him. Vickery never heard the shell that wounded him. He regained consciousness sometime in the early evening as he lay freezing in a ditch. He looked down and nearly fainted at the sight of his knee, a mess of splintered bone and blood. He forced himself to crawl out of the ditch back up to the path. He found his bike and blacked out beside it. Vickery came to in a field hospital the next morning. He knew the attack had gone forward because the hospital was overflowing. He lay in his bed all day, head swimming in a drowsy morphine haze, listening to the moaning of the wounded. At twilight, the boy in the next bed died. Vickery closed his eyes, trying to shut out the sound of the death rattle, but it was no good. Brendan Evans, his friend from Cambridge, who had helped Vickery deceive his way into the intelligence corps, came to see him the next morning. The war had changed him. His boyish good looks were gone. He looked like a hardened, somewhat cruel man. Brendan pulled up a chair and sat down next to the bed. "It's all my fault," Vickery told him. "I knew the Germans were waiting, but my motorbike broke down and I couldn't fix the damned thing. Then the shelling started." "I know. They found the papers in your saddlebag. No one's blaming you. It was just bloody awful luck, that's all. You probably couldn't have done anything to repair the bike in any case." Sometimes Vickery still heard the screams of the dying in his sleep. Even now, almost 30 years later. In recent days, his dream had taken a new twist. He dreamed it was Basil Boothby who had sabotaged his motorbike. "Ever read Fogel's file?" "No." "Liar. Perfect liar." Vickery had tried to refrain from the inevitable comparisons between then and now, but it was unavoidable. He did not believe in fate, but someone or something had given him another chance, a chance to redeem himself for his failure on that autumn day in 1916. Vickery thought the party in the pub across the street from MI5 headquarters would help him take his mind off the case. It had not. He had lingered at the fringes, thinking about France, gazing into his beer, watching while other officers flirted with the pretty typists. Nicholas Jago was giving a rather good account of himself at the piano. He was jolted out of his trance when one of the registry queens began singing "I'll Be Seeing You." She was an attractive crimson-lipped blonde named Grace Clarendon. Vickery knew she and Harry had carried on a rather public affair early in the war. Vickery understood the attraction. Grace was bright, witty, and cleverer than the rest of the girls in registry. But she was also married, and Vickery did not approve. He didn't tell Harry how he felt. It was none of his business. He thought, besides, who am I to lecture on matters of the heart? He suspected it was Grace who had told Harry about Boothby and the Fogel file. Harry walked in, bundled in his overcoat. He winked at Grace, then walked over to Vickery and said,
"Let's head back to the office. We need to talk." "Her name was Beatrice Pym. She lived alone in a cottage outside Ipswich," Harry began, as they walked upstairs to Vickery's office. He had spent several hours in Ipswich that morning, delving into Beatrice Pym's past. "No friends, no family. Her mother died in 1936. Left her the cottage and a fair amount of money. She didn't have a job. She had no boyfriends, no lovers, not even a cat. The only thing she did was paint."
"Paint?" Vickery asked.
"Yeah, paint. The people I spoke to said she painted almost every day. She left the cottage early in the morning, went into the surrounding countryside and spent all day painting. A detective from the Ipswich police showed me a couple of her paintings. Landscapes. Very nice, actually." Vickery frowned.
"I didn't know you had an eye for art, Harry."
"You think boys from Battersea can't appreciate the finer things? I'll have you know, my sainted mother regularly dragged me to the National Gallery.
I'm sorry, Harry. Please, continue.
Beatrice didn't own a car. She either rode her bicycle or walked or took the bus. She used to paint too long, especially in the summer when the light was good, and missed the last bus back. Her neighbours would spot her arriving home late at night on foot carrying her painting things. They say she spent the night in some god-awful places just to catch the sunrise.
What do they think happened to her?
The official version of the story, accidental drowning. Her belongings were found on the banks of the Orwell, including an empty bottle of wine. The police think she may have had a little too much to drink, lost her footing, slipped into the water and drowned. No body was found. They investigated for some time, but couldn't find any evidence to support any other theory. They declared her death an accidental drowning and closed the case.
Sounds like a very plausible story.
Sure, it could have happened that way. But I doubt it. Beatrice Pym was very familiar with the area. Why on that particular day did she have a little too much to drink and fall into the river?
Theory number two.
Theory number two goes as follows. She was picked up by our spy after dark, stabbed in the heart, and her body loaded into a van. Her things were left on the riverbank in order to make it appear like an accidental drowning. In reality, the corpse was driven across the country, mutilated and buried outside Whitchurch. They arrived in Vickery's office and sat down, Vickery behind the desk, Harry opposite. Harry leaned back in his chair and propped up his feet.
Is this all supposition, or do you have facts to support your theory?
Half and half, but it all fits your guess that Beatrice Pym was murdered in order to conceal the spy's entry into the country.
Let's hear it.
I'll start with the corpse. The body was discovered in August 1939. I spoke to the Home Office pathologist who examined it. Judging from the decomposition, he estimated it had been in the ground 6 to 9 months. That's consistent with Beatrice Pym's disappearance, by the way. The bones of the face had been almost completely shattered. There were no teeth to compare dental records. There were no fingerprints to be taken because the hands had badly decomposed. He was unable to fix a cause of death. He did find one interesting clue, though, a nick on the bottom rib of the left side. That nick is consistent with being stabbed in the chest.
You say the killer may have used a van? What's your evidence?
I asked the local police forces for reports on any crimes or disturbances around Whitchurch the night of Beatrice Pym's murder. Coincidentally, a van was deserted and set deliberately ablaze outside a village called Alderton. They ran a check on the van's identification number.
And?
Stolen in London 2 days earlier.
Vickery rose and began pacing. So our spy is in the middle of nowhere with a van blazing on the side of the road. Where does she go now? What does she do?
Let's assume she comes back to London. She flags down a passing car or lorry and asks for a lift. Or maybe she walks to the nearest station and takes the first train into London.
Too risky, Vickery said. A woman alone in the middle of the countryside late at night would be very unusual. It's November, so it's cold, too. She might be spotted by the police. The murder of Beatrice Pym was perfectly planned and executed. Her killer wouldn't leave her escape to chance.
How about a motorbike in the back of the van?
Good idea. Run a check. See if any motorbikes were stolen about that time.
She rides back to London and ditches the bike.
That's right, Vickery said. And when war breaks out, we don't look for a Dutch woman named Christa Kunst because we assume incorrectly that she's dead.
Clever as hell.
More ruthless than clever. Imagine killing an innocent British civilian to better conceal a spy. This is no ordinary agent, and Kurt Vogel is no ordinary control officer. I'm convinced of that.
Vickery paused to light a cigarette.
Has the photograph yielded any leads?
Nothing.
I think that leaves our investigation dead in the water.
I'm afraid you're right. I'll make a few more calls tonight.
Vickery shook his head. Take the rest of the night off. Go down to the party. Then he added, spend some time with Grace.
Harry looked up. How did you know?
This place is filled with intelligence officers, if you haven't noticed. Things get around, People talk. Besides, you two weren't exactly circumspect. You used to leave the number of Grace's flat with the night operators in case I was looking for you.
Harry's face reddened.
Go to her, Harry. She misses you. Any fool can see that.
I miss her, too. But she's married. I broke it off because I felt like a complete cad.
You make her happy, and she makes you happy. When her husband comes home, if her husband comes home, things will go back to normal.
And where does that leave me?
That's up to you.
It leaves me with a broken heart. That's what it leaves me. I'm crazy about Grace.
Then be with her and enjoy her company.
There's something else.
Harry told him about the other aspect of his guilt over his affair with Grace. That fact that he was in London chasing spies while Grace's husband and other men were risking their lives in the military.
I just don't know what I would do under fire, how I would react, whether I would be brave or whether I would be a coward. I also don't know whether I'm doing any damned good here. I could name 100 other detectives who can do what I do. Sometimes I think about giving Boothby my resignation and joining up.
Don't be ridiculous, Harry. When you do your job right, you save lives on the battlefield. The invasion of France is going to be won or lost before the first soldier ever sets foot on a French beach. Thousands of lives may depend on what you do. If you don't think you're doing your bit, think of it in those terms. Besides, I need you. You're the only one I can trust around here.
They sat in an awkward, embarrassed silence for a moment, the way Englishmen are apt to do after sharing private thoughts.
Harry stood up, started for the door, then stopped and turned around.
What about you, Alfred? Why is there no one in your life?
Why don't you come downstairs to the party and find a nice woman to spend some time with?
Vickery beat his breast pockets for his half-moon reading glasses and thrust them onto his face.
Good night, Harry, he said, a little too firmly, as he leafed through a stack of papers on the desk in front of him. Have fun at the party. I'll see you in the morning.
When Harry was gone, Vickery picked up the telephone and dialed Boothby's number. He was surprised when Boothby answered his own telephone. When Vickery asked if he was free, Sir Basil wondered aloud whether it could wait until Monday morning. Vickery said it was important. Sir Basil granted him an audience of 5 minutes and told Vickery to come upstairs straight away.
I've drafted this memorandum to General Eisenhower, General Betts, and the Prime Minister, Vickery said, when he finished briefing Boothby on Harry's discoveries that day.
He handed it to Boothby, who remained standing, feet slightly apart, as if for balance. He was in a hurry to leave for the country. His secretary had packed a secure briefcase of weekend reading material and a small leather grip of personal items. An overcoat hung over his shoulders, sleeves dangling at his sides.
To keep quiet about this any longer would be a dereliction of duty, in my opinion, Sir Basil.
Boothby was still reading. Vickery knew this because his lips were moving. He was squinting so hard his eyes had vanished into his lush brows. Sir Basil liked to pretend he still had perfect vision and refused to wear his reading glasses in front of the staff.
"I thought we'd discussed this once already, Alfred," Boothby said, waving the sheet of paper through the air.
A problem, once dealt with, should never resurface. It was one of Sir Basil's many personal and professional maxims. He was apt to grow agitated when subordinates raised matters already dispensed with. Careful deliberation and second-guessing were the province of weaker minds. Sir Basil valued quick decision-making over all else. Vickery glanced at Sir Basil's desk. It was clean, polished, and absolutely void of paper or files, a monument to Boothby's management style.
"We have discussed this once already, Sir Basil," Vickery said patiently. "But the situation has changed. It appears they've managed to insert an agent into the country, and that agent has met with an agent in place. It appears that their operation, whatever it may be, is now underway. To sit on this information instead of passing it on is to court disaster."
"Nonsense!" Boothby snapped.
"Why is it nonsense?" Because this department is not going to officially inform the Americans and the Prime Minister that it is incapable of performing its job, that it is incapable of controlling the threat posed to the invasion preparations by German spies.
That's not a valid reason for concealing this information.
It is a valid reason, Alfred, if I say it is a valid reason.
Conversations with Boothby often assumed the characteristics of a cat chasing its own tail. Shallow contradiction, bluff and diversion, point-scoring contests. Vickery bunched his hands judicially beneath his chin and pretended to study the pattern of Boothby's costly rug. The room was silent except for the sound of the floorboards creaking beneath Sir Basil's muscular bulk.
"Are you prepared to forward my memorandum to the Director-General?"
Vickery asked. His tone of voice was as unthreatening as possible.
"Absolutely not."
"Then I'm prepared to go directly to the DG myself."
Boothby bent his body and put his face close to Vickery's. Vickery, seated in Boothby's deep couch, could smell gin and cigarettes on his breath.
"And I'm prepared to squash you, Alfred. Sir Basil, let me remind you how the system works. You report to me, and I report to the Director General. You have reported to me, and I have determined it would be inappropriate to forward this matter to the DG at this time."
"There is one other option."
Boothby's head snapped back as if he'd been punched. He quickly regained his composure, setting his jaw in an angry scowl.
"I don't report to the Prime Minister, nor do I serve at his pleasure. But if you go around the department and speak directly to Churchill, I'll have you brought up before an internal review committee. By the time the committee is finished with you, they'll need dental records to identify the body."
"That's completely unfair."
"Is it? Since you've taken charge of this case, it's been one disaster after another. My God, Alfred, a few more German spies running loose in this country and they could form a rugby club."
Vickery refused to be baited.
"If you're not going to present my report to the Director General, I want the official record of this affair to reflect the fact that I made the suggestion at this time and you turned it down."
The corners of Boothby's mouth lifted into a terse smile. Protecting one's flank was something he understood and appreciated.
"Already thinking of your place in history, are you, Alfred?"
"You're a complete bastard, Sir Basil, and an incompetent one as well."
"You're addressing a senior officer, Major Vickery!"
"Believe me, I haven't missed the irony."
Boothby snatched up the briefcase and his leather grip, then looked at Vickery and said,
"You have a great deal to learn."
"I suppose I could learn it from you."
"And what in God's name is that supposed to mean?"
Vickery got to his feet.
"It means you should start thinking more about the security of this country and less about your personal advancement through Whitehall."
Boothby smiled easily, as if he were trying to seduce a younger woman.
"But my dear Alfred," he said, "I've always considered the two to be completely intertwined."
Chapter 21. East London. Catherine Blake had a stiletto hidden in her handbag the following evening as she hurried along the pavement toward the Pope's warehouse. She had demanded a meeting alone with Vernon Pope, and as she approached the warehouse, she saw no sign of Pope's men. She stopped at the gate and turned the latch. It was unlocked, just as Pope said it would be. She pulled it open and stepped inside. The warehouse was a place of shadows, the only illumination from a light hanging at one end of the room. Catherine walked toward the light and found the freight lift. She stepped inside, pulled the gate closed, and pressed the button. The lift groaned and shuddered upward toward Pope's office. The lift emptied onto a small landing with a set of black double doors. Catherine knocked and heard Pope's voice on the other side tell her to enter. He was standing at a drinks trolley, a bottle of champagne in one hand, a pair of glasses in the other. He held one out toward Catherine as she walked across the floor.
"No, thank you," she said. "I'm just staying for a minute."
"I insist," he said. "Things got a little tense the last time we were together. I want to make it up to you."
"Is that why you had me followed?" she said, accepting the wine.
"I have everyone followed, darling. That's how I stay in business. My boys are good at it, as you'll see when you read this."
He held out an envelope toward Catherine, then pulled it away as her hand reached for it.
That's why I was so surprised when you managed to give Dicky the slip. That was smooth, ducking into the underground and then jumping on a bus.
I changed my mind. She drank some of the champagne. It was ice cold and excellent. Pope held out the envelope again and this time allowed Catherine to take it. She set down her glass and opened it. It was exactly what she needed, a minute-by-minute accounting of Peter Jordan's movements around London, where he worked, the hours he kept, the places he did his eating and drinking, even the name of a friend. While she finished reading, Pope took the champagne from the ice bucket and poured another glass for himself. Catherine reached inside her handbag, took out the money, and dropped it on the table. "Here's the rest," she said. "I think that concludes our business. Thank you very much." She was slipping the report on Peter Jordan into her purse when Pope stepped forward and loosened her grip on the bag.
"Actually, Catherine, darling, our business together has just begun."
"If it's more money you want..."
"Oh, I want more money. And if you don't want me to make a call to the police, you're going to give it to me."
He took another step closer to her, pressed his body against hers, and ran his hand over her breasts.
"But there's something else I want from you."
The bedroom doors opened, and Vivi stood there, wearing nothing but one of Vernon's shirts unbuttoned to her waist.
"Vivi, meet Catherine," Pope said. "Lovely Catherine has agreed to stay for the evening."
They didn't prepare her for situations like this at the Abwehr spy school in Berlin. They taught her how to count troops, how to assess an army, how to use her radio, how to recognize the insignia of units and the faces of senior officers. But they never taught her how to deal with a London gangster and his kinky girlfriend who planned to spend the evening taking turns with her body. She had the sensation of being trapped in some silly pubescent fantasy. She thought, this can't really be happening. But it was happening, and Catherine could think of nothing from her training to get her through it. Vernon Pope led her through the doors into the bedroom. He pushed her down at the end of the bed, then sat down in a chair in the corner of the room. Vivi stood in front of her and undid the last two buttons of the shirt. She had small, upturned breasts and pale skin that shone in the dim light of the room. She took hold of Catherine's head and pulled it to her breasts. Catherine played along with the depraved game, taking Vivi's nipple into her mouth, while she thought about how best to kill them both. Catherine knew once she submitted to blackmail, it would never end. Her financial resources were not unlimited. Vernon Pope could bleed her dry very quickly. With no money, she would be rendered useless. She decided there was little risk involved. She had covered her tracks carefully. The Popes and their men did not know where to find her. They only knew she worked as a volunteer nurse at St. Thomas Hospital, and Catherine had given the hospital a false address. They would also be reluctant to go to the police. The police would ask questions. Answering them truthfully would mean admitting to following an American naval officer for money. All of it hinged on killing Vernon Pope as quickly and quietly as possible. Catherine took Vivi's other breast into her mouth and sucked the nipple until it became firm. Vivi's head rolled back and she moaned. She took Catherine's hand and guided it between her legs. Already she was warm and wet. Catherine had turned off all her emotions. She was just mechanically going through the movements of giving physical pleasure to this woman. She felt neither fear nor revulsion. She simply tried to remain calm and to think clearly. Vivi's pelvis began to work against Catherine's fingers, and a moment later her body trembled with an orgasm. Vivi pushed Catherine down onto the bed, sat astride her hips, and began undoing the buttons of her sweater. She unhooked Catherine's brassiere and massaged her breasts. Catherine saw Vernon rise from his seat and begin to undress. For the first time, she became nervous. She didn't want him on top of her or inside her. He might be a cruel and sadistic lover. He might hurt her. On her back, with her legs spread, she would be vulnerable. She would also be subject to his superior weight and strength. All the fighting techniques she had learned hinged on speed and maneuverability. If she were pinned beneath Vernon Pope's heavy body, she would be defenseless. Catherine had to play their game. Better still, she had to control it. She reached up and took Vivi's breasts in her hands and stroked the nipples. She could see Vernon watching them. He was feeding on them with his eyes, drinking in the sight of the two women caressing each other. She drew Vivi toward her and guided her mouth to her breasts. Catherine thought how easy it would be to take Vivi's head in her hands and twist it until her neck snapped, but it would be a mistake. She needed to kill Pope first. Vivi would be easy after that. Pope walked toward the bed and nudged Vivi aside. Before Vernon could lie down on top of her, Catherine sat up and kissed him. She got to her feet as his tongue thrashed wildly about inside her mouth. She fought off an impulse to gag. For a moment she considered allowing him to make love to her, then killing him afterward when he was drowsy and satisfied. But she didn't want it to go on longer than was absolutely necessary. She stroked his penis. He groaned and kissed her harder. He was helpless now. She turned him so that his back faced the bed. Then she slammed her knee viciously into his groin. Pope doubled over, gasping for breath, hands between his thighs. Vivi screamed. Catherine spun and drove her elbow into the bridge of his nose. She could hear the sound of the bone and cartilage snapping. Pope collapsed onto the floor at the foot of the bed, blood pouring from his nostrils. Vivi was kneeling on the bed, screaming. She was no threat to Catherine now. She turned and moved quickly for the door. Pope, still on the floor, swung his leg. It smashed into Catherine's right ankle and caused her own legs to become entangled. She crashed to the floor, the heavy fall taking her breath away. She saw stars for a moment and tears spilled into her eyes. She feared she was about to lose consciousness. She struggled to her hands and knees and was about to climb to her feet when Pope grabbed her ankle in a vice grip and began dragging her toward him. She rolled quickly onto her side and drove the heel of her shoe into his broken nose. Pope screamed in agony, but his grip on her ankle seemed only to tighten. She kicked him a second time, then a third. Finally, he let her go. Catherine scrambled to her feet and ran to the couch where Pope had made her leave her handbag. She opened it and unzipped the inner compartment. The stiletto was there. She took hold of the handle and pressed the release. The blade snapped into place. Pope was on his feet, plunging through the darkness, hands reaching out for her. Catherine spun around and lashed out wildly with the weapon. The tip of the blade tore a gash across his right shoulder. Pope grabbed the wound with his left hand, screaming in pain as blood began to pump between his fingers. His arm was across his chest, no way to plunge the stiletto into his heart. The Abwehr had taught her another method that made her cringe just to think about, but she would have to use it now. No other choice. Catherine took a step closer, drew back the stiletto, and rammed it through Vernon Pope's eye. Vivi was in the corner of the bedroom, lying on the floor in a fetal position, weeping hysterically. Catherine took her by the arm, pulled her to her feet, and pushed her back against the wall.
"Please, don't hurt me!"
"I'm not going to hurt you."
"Don't hurt me!"
"I'm not going to hurt you."
"I promise I won't tell anyone, not even Robert, I swear!"
"Nor the police?"
"I won't tell the police."
"Good. I knew I could trust you." Catherine stroked her hair, touched her face. Vivi seemed to relax. Her body went limp and Catherine had to hold her up to keep her from collapsing onto the floor.
"What are you?"
Vivi asked.
"How could you do that to him?"
Catherine said nothing, just stroked Vivi's hair while her other hand gently searched for the soft spot at the bottom of the ribcage. Vivi's eyes opened wide as the stiletto slid into her heart. A cry of pain caught in her throat and came out as a low gurgle. She died quickly and quietly, blank eyes staring into Catherine's. Catherine released her. The motion of the body sliding down the wall pulled the stiletto from her heart. Catherine looked at the human wreckage all around her, the blood. "My God, what have they made of me?" Then she fell to her knees next to Vivi's dead body and was violently sick. She conducted the rituals of escape with surprising calmness. In the bathroom, she washed their blood from her hands, from her face, and from the blade of the stiletto. There was nothing she could do about the blood on her sweater except conceal it beneath her leather coat. She walked through the bedroom, past the body of the woman, and into the next room. She went to the window and looked down into the street. Pope, it appeared, had kept his word. There was no one outside the warehouse. They would surely find his body in the morning, though, and when they did, they would come after her. For now, at least, she was safe. She collected her handbag, and from the table, the £100 in cash she had given Pope. She took the lift down, crossed the warehouse floor, and slipped out into the night. Chapter 22 East London. Detective Superintendent Andrew Kidlington, unlike most members of his profession, avoided murder scenes when he could. A lay preacher in his local church, he had lost his taste for the more ghoulish side of his profession long ago. He had assembled a thoroughly professional team of officers and believed it best to give them free rein. He had a legendary ability to deduce more about a murder from a good file than from a visit to the crime scene, and he made certain every shred of paper generated by his department crossed his desk. But it wasn't every day that someone stuck a knife in a man like Vernon Pope. This one he had to see for himself. The uniformed officer standing watch outside the warehouse door moved aside as Kidlington approached.
"The lift is at the far end of the warehouse, sir. Take it up one level. There's another man on the landing. He'll show you the way."
Kidlington slowly crossed the warehouse floor. He was tall and angular, with a head of woolly grey hair and the look of someone perpetually preparing to break bad news. As a result, his men tended to tread lightly around him. A young detective sergeant named Meadows was waiting for him on the landing. Meadows was too flashy for Kidlington's taste and put himself about with too many women, but he was an excellent detective and had promotion written all over him.
"Pretty messy in there, sir," Meadows said.
Kidlington could taste blood in the air as Meadows led him inside. Vernon Pope's body lay on an oriental rug next to the couch. The dark circle of blood extended beyond the grey covering sheet. Kidlington, despite 30 years on the Metropolitan Police, still felt bile rising in his throat when Meadows knelt beside the body and drew back the sheet.
"Good Lord," Kidlington said beneath his breath.
He made a face and turned away for a moment to regain his composure.
"I've never seen one like this," Meadows said.
The dead body of Vernon Pope was lying naked, face up, in a pool of dried black blood. It was obvious to Kidlington that the fatal wound was struck only after a brutal struggle. There was a large, ragged slash across his shoulder. The nose had been badly broken. Blood had drained from both nostrils into the mouth, which had fallen open in death, as if to issue one last scream. Then there was the eye. Kidlington had trouble looking at it. Blood and ocular fluid had drained down the side of his face. The eyeball was destroyed, the pupil no longer visible. It would take an autopsy to determine the true depth of the wound, but it appeared to be the fatal blow. Someone had shoved something through Vernon Pope's eye and into his brain. Kidlington broke the silence.
"Approximate time of death?"
"Sometime last night, perhaps early evening."
"Weapon?"
"Hard to say. Certainly not an ordinary knife. Look at the shoulder. The edges of the wound are ragged."
"Conclusion?"
"Something sharp. A screwdriver. An ice pick, perhaps."
Kidlington glanced across the room.
"Pope's is still on the drinks trolley. Unless your killer is walking around with his own ice pick, I doubt it was the murder weapon."
Kidlington looked down at the body again.
"I'd say it was a stiletto. It's a stabbing weapon, not a slashing weapon. That would account for the ragged wound on the shoulder and the clean puncture wound in the eye."
"Right, sir."
Kidlington had seen enough. He rose to his feet and gestured for Meadows to cover the body.
"The woman?"
"In the bedroom. This way, sir."
Robert Pope sat in the passenger seat of the van, pale and shaking visibly, as Dickie Dobbs drove at speed towards St. Thomas Hospital. It was Robert who had discovered the bodies of his brother and Vivi earlier that morning. He had waited for Vernon at the East End Café, where they ate breakfast each morning, and became alarmed when he didn't appear. He fetched Dickie from his flat and went to the warehouse. When he saw the bodies, he screamed and put his foot through the glass table. Robert and Vernon Pope were realistic men. They realized they were in a risky line of work, and that one or both of them might die young. Like all siblings, they fought sometimes, but Robert Pope loved his older brother more than anything else in the world. Vernon had been like a father to him when their own father, an abusive, unemployed alcoholic, walked out and never came back. It was the way he died that had horrified Robert the most, stabbed through the eye, left on the floor naked, and Vivi, an innocent, stabbed through the heart. It was possible the killings were the work of one of their enemies. Their operation had thrived during the war, and they had branched out into new territory. But it didn't look like any gang murder he had ever seen. Robert suspected it had something to do with the woman, Catherine, or whatever her name really was. He had made an anonymous call to the police. They would have to get involved at some point, but he wouldn't rely on them to find his brother's killer. He would do it himself. Dickie parked along the river and entered the hospital through a service door. He came out again 5 minutes later and walked back to the van. Pope asked,
"Was he there?"
"Yeah. He thinks he can get it for us."
"How long?"
20 minutes. Half an hour later, a thin man with a pinched face, dressed in an orderly's uniform, emerged from the back of the hospital and trotted over to the van. Dickie wound down the window.
"I've got it, Mr. Pope," he said. "A girl in the front office gave it to me. She said it was against the rules, but I sweet-talked her. Promised her a fiver. Hope you don't mind."
Dickie held out his hand, and the orderly gave him a slip of paper. Dickie passed it across to Pope.
"Good work, Sammy," Pope said, looking at it. "Give him his money, Dickie."
The orderly took the money, a disappointed look on his face. Dickie said,
"What's wrong, Sammy?"
10 bob, just like I promised."
"What about the fiver for the girl?"
"Consider that your overhead," Pope said.
"But Mr. Pope!"
"Sammy, you don't want to fuck with me just now."
Dickie dropped the van into gear and sped away, tires squealing. "Where's the address?" Dickie asked.
"Islington! Move it!"
Mrs. Eunice Wright of number 23 Norton Lane, Islington, was very much like her house. Tall, narrow, mid-50s, all Victorian sturdiness and Victorian manners. She did not know, nor would she ever know, even when the entire disagreeable episode was over, that the house had been used as a false address by an agent of German military intelligence called Catherine Blake. For 2 weeks, Eunice Wright had been waiting for a repairman to come look at her cracked boiler. Before the war, the tenants in her well-kept boarding house were mostly young men, who were always willing to help when something went wrong with the pipes or the stove. Now all the young men were away in the army. Her own son, never far from her thoughts, was somewhere in North Africa. She took no pleasure in her present tenants, two old men who talked a great deal about the last war, two rather daft country girls who had fled their dreary East Midlands village for factory jobs in London. When Leonard was alive, he saw to all the repairs, but Leonard had been dead for 10 years. She stood in the window of the drawing room, sipping tea. The house was quiet. The men were upstairs playing draughts. She had insisted they play without slapping the pieces so as not to wake the girls, who had just come off a night shift. Bored, she switched on the wireless and listened to the news bulletin on the BBC. The van, when it drew to a halt in front of her house, struck her as odd. It bore no markings. No company name painted on the side, and the two men in front didn't look like any repairmen she had ever seen. The one behind the wheel was tall and thick, with close-cropped hair and a neck so enormous it looked as though his head was simply attached to his shoulders. The other one was smaller, dark-haired, and looked mad at the world. Their clothing was odd, too. Instead of workmen's overalls, they wore suits, quite expensive suits by the look of them. They opened the doors and got out. Eunice took note of the fact they carried no tools. Perhaps they wanted to survey the damage to her boiler before dragging all the tools inside. Just being thorough, making sure they bring only those tools that are necessary for the job. She studied them more carefully as they moved toward her front door. They looked reasonably healthy. Why weren't they in the army? She noticed the way they glanced over their shoulders into the street as they came closer, as though they were trying to make their approach unobserved. Suddenly, she wished Leonard were here. There was nothing polite about the knock. She imagined policemen knocked that way when they thought a criminal was on the other side. Another knock, so forceful it rattled the glass of the drawing-room window. Upstairs, the game of draughts went quiet. She went to the door. She told herself there was no reason to be afraid. They just lacked the good manners common to most English handymen. It was the war. The experienced repairmen were in the service, working on bombers or frigates. The bad ones, like the pair outside, were holding down jobs at home. Slowly, she opened the door. She wanted to ask them to be as quiet as possible so they would not wake the girls. She never got the words out. The large one, the one with no neck, shoved back the door with his forearm, then clamped his hand over her mouth. Eunice tried to scream, but it seemed to die quietly in the back of her throat, making almost no audible sound. The smaller one put his face to her ear and spoke with a serenity that only frightened her more.
"Just give us what we want, love, and no one gets hurt," he said.
Then he pushed past her and started up the stairs. Detective Sergeant Meadows considered himself a minor authority on the Pope gang. He knew how they made their money, legally and illegally, and he could recognize most of the gang members by name and face. So when he heard the description of the two men who just ransacked a boarding house in Islington, he wrapped up his business at the murder scene and headed there to see things for himself. The first description matched Richard Dickie Dobbs, the Pope's main muscle boy and enforcer. The other matched Robert Pope himself. Meadows, as was his habit, paced the drawing room while Eunice Wright, sitting bolt upright in a chair, patiently recounted the story again, even though she had told it twice already. Her cup of tea had given way to a small glass of sherry. Her face bore the handprint of her assailant, and she had received a bump on the head when shoved to the floor. Otherwise, she was not seriously injured.
"And they didn't tell you who or what they were looking for?" Meadows asked, ceasing his pacing only long enough to ask the question.
"No."
"Did they call each other by name?"
"No, I don't believe so."
"Did you happen to see the plate number on the van?"
"No, but I did give a description to one of the other officers."
"It's a very common model, Mrs. Wright. I'm afraid the description alone won't be of much value to us. I'll have one of the men check with the neighbors."
"I'm sorry," she said, rubbing the back of her head.
"Are you all right?"
"He gave me a nasty bump on the head, the ruffian."
"Perhaps you should see a doctor." "I'll have one of the officers give you a lift when we're finished here."
"Thank you. That's very kind of you."
Meadows picked up his raincoat and put it on.
"Did they say anything else that you can remember?"
"Well, they did say one other thing."
Eunice Wright hesitated a moment, and her face coloured.
"The language is a little on the rough side, I'm afraid."
"I assure you I won't be offended."
"The smaller one said, 'When I find that—'"
She paused, lowering her voice, embarrassed to say the words.
"When I find that fucking bitch, I'm going to kill her myself."
Meadows frowned.
"You're certain of that?"
"Oh, yes. When you don't often hear language like that, it's hard to forget."
"I'll say."
He handed her his card. "If you think of anything else, please don't hesitate to call. Good morning, Mrs. Wright."
"Good morning, Detective Sergeant."
Meadows put on his hat and saw himself to the door. So they were looking for a woman. Maybe it wasn't the Popes after all. Maybe it was just two blokes looking for a girl. Maybe the similar descriptions were just coincidence. Meadows didn't believe in coincidence. He would drive back to the Pope's warehouse and see if anyone had spotted a woman hanging around there lately.